Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Thursday, the 7th of August, the day before the start of the Olympics in Beijing, and we have a perfect guest for this hour. On August 8, 3 years to the day before the start of the Olympics, and 68 years after the Japanese marched in to occupy Beijing, Michael Meyer, also known to his Chinese friends as Little Plum Blossom, moved into a traditional courtyard home on Red Bayberry and Bamboo Slanted Street in the Hutong, the vanishing back streets of the city. His neighborhood, 6 centuries old, once known as the Entertainment District, with artisans and acrobats, antiques and brothels. He, the only Westerner among the 57,000 residents, he says that Beijing was simply love at first sight. He writes about these back streets. He writes about his time as a teacher in Beijing and how preparations for the Olympics were made many years ago. And the big story that runs through this is the transformation of Beijing, such a historic area, very, very old, and how the Hutongs are disappearing at a fairly rapid rate. What's replacing them? What happens when we lose that sense of history, that ground that our parents and our grandparents and our great-great-parents walked on and raised their families? We will talk about all of that, as well as the preparation for the Olympics that's been going on in China. Michael is, he first went to China after graduating from UW-Madison, actually, a Madison connection, to be in the Peace Corps in 1995. He's been a longtime teacher and travel writer, publishing stories in the Smithsonian Time, New York Times Book Review, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, and many other major publications. In China, he represented the National Geographic Society's Center for Sustainable Destinations, training China's UNESCO World Heritage Site Managers in preservation practices. We'll be welcoming phone calls from Michael. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that at talk@wpr.org. Michael is in Beijing right now. His home is just south of Tiananmen Square. And we welcome you, Michael, to the show. Big week in China.
Oh, there's not too much going on yet. No, thank you for having me, Kathleen. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. You write that Beijing was simply love at first sight, Michael. How so?
Well, when I was in Peace Corps, I was in Sichuan Province, which is in China's southwest, and that is an area of terraced rice fields and oppressive heat and sort of not so mild winters. I grew up in Minnesota, and I prefer cornfields and winter. So when I moved to Beijing, the topography was quite similar to where I grew up in Minnesota, actually. It's very flat, quite dry, but with bracing, wonderful winters, which I quite enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And you moved into this area. It was not very easy living for you. Can you describe what Hutongs, where the word comes from, and what that means, and what your place was like?
Sure. Hutong, well, it's funny. Anything with Beijing urban planning history, there's multiple interpretations. But as far as we know, Hutong comes from a Mongolian word, which means water well or a path between tents. And when Marco Polo arrived in the city in the 13th century, when he saw Kublai Khan's capital here, which was the Mongolian capital at the time, he marveled at the chessboard arrangement of the streets, and that was these Hutong. Hutong are to Beijing what the canals are to Venice.
Mm.
And you can picture that. The difference being that here, the architectural ratio is 1-to-1, meaning the street is as narrow as the buildings are tall.
Mm.
Venice has palaces that line its canals. So here you have this very narrow street, a one-story home, and the homes are all interconnected. And so you have this contiguous street wall that when you're on a lane, you just feel like you're being nestled or hugged. You know, the city's actually putting its arms around you.
Oh, that's nice. Although the living is not very easy, right? You're in a little tiny place. There's a bathroom and a toilet down the street a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the book is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Back Streets of a City Transformed. And not everyone is sad to see the last days of old Beijing pass away,
mm-hmm.
because it is difficult living. It's kind of like urban camping when you live in these old lanes that haven't been upgraded. Chinese traditional architecture uses impermanent materials, unlike Western European capital architecture. And so it's wood, it's brick that have just eroded over the decades as the city's neglected to care for it. And so it's really an illustrative metaphor for modern-day Beijing. I have a cold water tap. I don't have heat. I don't have an indoor toilet, but I do have broadband internet access. The telecom company just strung the broadband line over a tiled rooftop and into my house. But the other infrastructure, you know, there's other things they just can't install because the house is just too fragile to add pipes and new wiring.
Oh, my. What in the world do you do in the winter? You don't even burn coal. You must be freezing.
Yeah, I am. And I play hockey, and I play hockey on the Forbidden City Moat. I spend my mornings there, and then afterwards, you know, you're drenched in sweat from skating, and there's no hot water at home, so you go to a public bathhouse and try to warm up there. And then when you come home, a lot of the people in the neighborhood burn coal honeycomb cakes, but I was afraid of being asphyxiated because it happened to parents of one of my students. And so I use an electric heater, but the electric heater, when I turn it on, it always blows the courtyard's fuses. I have a refrigerator, too, but I had to unplug that because that also blew our fuses. So now the refrigerator is a closet, and it stores my underwear.
Oh, my gosh. You decided that you were going to teach, and you walked into a school in the area and just said that you would like to teach for free. That must have been shocking to the people in the school. You wanted what?
When I was a Peace Corps volunteer in China, people always looked at me and thought, what sort of a nation sends its young people overseas to work with strangers instead of taking care of their own family?
Hmm.
And it was the same in Beijing in 2005 when I went to the school. And I have a master's degree in education, and I have teaching licenses, and I had translations of all that. But when I presented them to the school guards, you know, they wouldn't even open the gate to get in. And then the principal herself said, no one's ever done this before. And the way you advance in China is to manage risks, not by taking them. You know, you want to maintain the status quo. So she, to her credit, lobbied hard to get the police and the Education Bureau to approve me. And after a month, they finally did, and I was able to start teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you've been a teacher, you know this, too. That's a dirty secret. Being a volunteer is always better than accepting paid employment, because when you're a volunteer, you don't have to attend meetings.
Right.
You just get to come and do your teaching and work with the kids and then leave, which is why I did it, one of the reasons.
Right. And tell me about the kids in this area. Tell me about the educational system. The kids are described in many different ways. They're not, they're kind of forgotten students in a way, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This neighborhood is in the most visible part of Beijing. It's right on the edge of Tiananmen Square. From our classroom windows, you can see the Great Hall of the People, China's Parliament building. You can see Chairman Mao's mausoleum. You can see the Gate of the Forbidden City. And yet we're right up against that. And yet it's this area of a half square mile. The Vatican City is also a half square mile, but Vatican City is 500 people. This half square mile has 57,000 people living in these conditions. And they're poor. It's not a slum. Their sin is that they're the working class poor. Many of them are migrants that have come to the city, you know, to try to earn money and try to buy into this economic miracle. But the education level is quite low in the neighborhood. A lot of the parents never finished high school. And the school, I mean, Beijing has schools now with climbing walls and swimming pools and whatnot. But our school was a very simple brick structure with not a lot of technology. And it was, you know, it's one of those things. The kids started studying English in grade one, but all of the instruction was automated. And so they studied off of DVDs or cassettes that wasn't really helping them attain proficiency. And then to add insult to injury, there are no proficiency levels in Beijing when you're learning English. And so all the best students and all the worst students sort of slide into the middle.
Mm.
And so the kids, I have to say, they did their best, and they're really the hope of their parents. They're single children due to the policy, and the parents want them to succeed at school. It's very, very important now. But these kids had some odds stacked against them coming in.
Right. And they also have, because the language is so different in many ways, Chinese is so descriptive, given your nickname, given the name of the streets, given how vegetables are named, et cetera, that it takes quite a bit of explaining to the students for them to understand certain words in English.
It was also difficult for them to understand how they could possibly use any of the words that they were being taught. There's an example. I mean, the character in these textbooks is a monkey named Maki. Maki leads all the lessons, And Maki sounds like Truman Capote on helium. I mean, he's very hard to understand to begin with. But Maki's white collar. He's a white collar monkey, and he wants to be a doctor, an airline pilot when he grows up. The kids, though, when I ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up, they couldn't find that vocabulary. You know, one kid yelled out, I want to be a foreigner. You know, he thought it would be great to leave the country and work overseas. And when I asked, what do your parents do for a living? I mean, we filled the board with road repairman, cell phone repairman, you know, vegetable seller, and all these words that aren't in the book to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Did you find it gratifying teaching at the school?
It was the most gratifying teaching I've ever done in my
really?
Life. I've always
really?
Been the guy that I like teaching 9th grade, 10th grade. I like teaching sort of surly adolescents who are trying to find their way. And I was really surprised. And I think the reason I enjoyed the teaching so much is that I was able to take the same 60 kids from grade 4 into grade 5 into grade 6. So I was with the same bunch of kids over a period of over 2 years before they took their middle school exams. And that made it very gratifying because I got to know their parents quite well. I got to know their abilities quite well, and that certainly helped their education, too.
Right. There are so many dramatic pictures in the book, and you talk about the stories of people having to leave the Hutongs because of the redevelopment that's taking place, and in many cases moving miles and miles away to these high-rise apartments. And you can't imagine how difficult it must be to make such an adjustment.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And you know, this policy of renovating the inner city of Old Beijing. Old Beijing is 25 square miles. It's about the size of Manhattan. So it's not a very large area. But really, since 1991, long before Beijing won the rights to host these Olympics that start tomorrow, in the 90s, they began tearing down these neighborhoods. And it dovetailed with a time when the city said district governments were going to have to fund themselves. They weren't going to get revenues from the state or the main city government anymore. So the way these district governments funded themselves was to transfer land rights to developers and basically would just sell off these huge neighborhoods en masse and say, okay, you can develop them. And these people were evicted. Now, from 91 to 2001, you were given an apartment. You were assigned an apartment in the outlying suburbs. In 2001, that policy changed, and now you're given a cash settlement. But the cash settlement is maybe $1,000 a square meter, when land in central Beijing right now is $6,000 to $7,000 a square meter. So these people still have to move far, far away. And that's what really surprised me in the book. That was a discovery. I thought people would be lamenting, oh, our beautiful old house we're losing. No, they lamented this very dense social network that had formed where they lived, a community that looked out for one another, that helped one another, that you know, it was quite safe and enjoyable to live in. And when all of a sudden that's scattered and you have to start anew. When I visit people that have moved, you know, 20 miles outside the city center, it's like talking to someone who's lost a parent or a spouse. You know, they feel like almost this phantom itch, you know, that sometimes they talk to people that they think are still around, but they aren't there and stuff. It's quite haunting. It takes years to readjust.
And they raised the Hutong just for urban development, in part for the Olympics. Why have so many disappeared?
Well, it really began, Beijing first bid to host the 2000 Olympics, which went to Sydney, and as part of that, city beautification campaign was going to begin in 1991. And so it began, the raising of the Hutong began then. I mean, in 1949, there were 7,000 of these lanes. In the 1990s, they were disappearing at about 600 a year. Developers were just, it was easier to clear the land rather than repair the houses and build high-rises or commercial space on them. And so they disappeared quite rapidly. Now we're down to about 1,300 to 1,800 of these lanes remain. The Olympics, people often say, oh, the Olympics are destroying Old Beijing. In fact, there's no Olympic stadium that's been built inside of Old Beijing. Most are in the far northern suburbs. The only events that are in the old city actually go through our neighborhood is the marathon passes through and also a bicycling event. So nothing was torn down because of the Olympics. But now, having said that, once Beijing was awarded the Olympics, of course, land value skyrocketed because Beijing has put $40 billion into city development for these games.
Wow.
And the slogan for their winning bid was, New Beijing, New Olympics. Now, I'll just finish this. The journalism professor who authored that said, by New Beijing, I meant a more humanistic Beijing, but instead the city planners have taken New Beijing to mean flatten Old Beijing and build a new Beijing.
Oh, my. And the people who are in the area where you have lived, what are the, do they have pride? I know that you were teaching several years ago, actually, the school children in the building where you were learning the visitor's song, and the mascot was there covered in plastic so the tobacco smoke wouldn't get on the mascot. What about this extensive preparations that we've all heard about? Did you saw it in your school, right?
Definitely. And that's part of a trend, though. I mean, I came to China in 1995, so I've been here since Hong Kong was handed back to the motherland, as they say, in 1997. And I've been here for the passing of Deng Xiaoping, and I've been here through one campaign after another. And there's just, as China becomes more and more modern and more economically stable and more economically powerful, it stands to reason that patriotism has also risen along with that, because more people are buying into the status quo and saying, we can be here. Our country is working. And so the Olympics were just the crowning achievement of this. And people were so excited when it was awarded. I mean, tears, and, you know, 300,000 people thronged into Tiananmen Square to celebrate. And even when I began teaching at the school in 2005, all of the designs that were chalked on our blackboards were Olympic designs and Olympic slogans. And it was to the extent where Beijing had a rule that all schools had to keep a countdown clock marking how many days remained until the opening ceremony. Now, most Beijing schools had an electronic countdown clock. Our school was quite limited, shall we say. And so each classroom chalked on the board how many days until the Olympics. Now, this being an elementary school, though, okay, the policy was chalk the days until the start of the Olympics. You're in an elementary school, you're busy. Not one classroom in my building ever had the correct number of days until the Olympics began. But they still kind of tried to keep their count because they were excited about it. And, you know, I teach grade 4, grade 5, into grade 6, and these kids who are 9, 10, 11 years old, this is the most exciting thing that's ever happened in their lives. You know, Beijing doesn't have professional sports franchises that they could have, you know, experienced, let's say, the equivalent of a World Series win. So this is, it's been building this, the sort of civic pride has been all around these games, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it sure will. We're going to welcome phone calls from Michael. Michael Meyer is our guest. His book is The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. Our number, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us this hour, the day before the Olympics start in Beijing, Michael Meyer. His book is The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. You can also call him by his Chinese name, which is Plum Blossom. And we welcome phone calls. Let's start our calls with Kate from Milwaukee. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much. I actually just wanted to confirm that this your guest actually went to Madison. Did he go to Madison?
He did, yeah. You did, didn't you, Michael?
I did. This person's voice sounds awfully familiar. I got a chill.
You what?
I just got a chill. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, and the reason I'm asking is because I think I was in your writing workshop. I was there between 90 and 94.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, I'm so proud of you. I knew it was you as soon as I heard your voice, and I knew you would do this. You had recommended that totally bizarre transcendental existential whatnot with the motorcycle madness book to me. Do you remember that?
I do, and you know, it's funny, Kathleen, this is actually a true story. We didn't set this up. This person, Kate, who's calling, she told me once in 1994, you're going to write something one day, and it's going to be good. I don't know what it's going to be, but you're going to do it.
That's exactly
so, Kate,
what I said.
Go.
I am so proud of you, Plum Blossom. I'm just blowing all over the place, and I am going to go buy your book. I am thrilled for you.
And, Kate, go to my website and write me an email, lastdaysofoldbeijing.com, okay?
Oh, great.
I absolutely will. I actually am interested, then, in your perspective, and I'm so proud, too, of, you know, that you definitely stayed true to everything that you were all about when we were in school in terms of you saying that this rewarding experience of really getting your hands dirty and getting in there with the kids. So I feel like you've got a great perspective on what's really going on right now in terms of the protests about the Olympics, and I'm wondering what you might be able to offer in terms of, like, a real world, real you know, kind of on the street perspective of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I saw some coverage of it yesterday. I mean, which ones are we talking about? I guess I should ask. A banner being hung from a light post, or people angry about evictions, or
yeah. Well, I'm actually curious about if it's really anything that's kind of organic internally versus a lot of people coming into the country and kind of trying to make a statement where they have to go to the police station to ask for permission to be in the certain protest zones and all that.
Right.
Kind of stuff.
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, I think the city doesn't feel like it's under any more police control than normal. And Beijing has security cameras all over the place, but so does London. So does a lot of cities. But the difference right now is that you see police officers out, but Beijing cops aren't like American cops. They kind of mediate rather than fight crime. The difference, though, is that right now, like every 20 meters or every 20 yards in the city seems to be someone like over age 60 wearing a polo shirt that's been newly issued to them that identifies them as a quote-unquote security volunteer. And basically what that means is if they see anything suspicious, they're going to get on the phone and make a call. And that's really, that's how many people have been mobilized for this. And I'll give you an example. I had a friend over to my house this morning, a foreign friend, and someone on the street said, "Plum Blossom, who is that?" And I said, "Oh, he's my friend." And the person still got out their cell phone and said, "Well, I'm going to have to call the police because you're having a visitor."
Oh, my.
And I said, "You've got to be kidding me." So the person called the police, and the police, of course, said, "What do we care what Plum Blossom's doing? Leave the guy alone." So, you know, it's one of those things that can do a certain to a certain extent. Like, if people know you or you're part of your community, you're fine. But I think, if you're an outsider, people are going to be a little more suspicious of you. And there are eyes on the street waiting for that.
Hmm.
So it does seem that maybe there's more external kind of rebel rousing. Do you know what I mean?
No, not yet. But you know what? A lot of people haven't come here yet. It's weird how empty the city is. This is going to be something that listeners probably won't believe. Traffic is great. There was a lot of visa problems for people getting in, and there was a lot of, you know, after the Sichuan earthquake and everything's going on with China, that I'm surprised. I thought I'd see delegations of Westerners and whatnot here. I haven't yet. I think that'll start happening over the weekend.
Yeah, well, I know I'm watching, and I'm so proud of you. Well done.
Thanks, Kate.
It's
bye.
Great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, that was degrees of separation. There's just not
blushing.
Many. Just not many.
How Once did you, a badger, always a badger.
I
what
guess,
can I say?
Yeah. How did you get the name Plum Blossom?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because it sounds funny. He's Plum Blossom. My last name is Meyer, and I come from a really big family, and most of the men in my family are named Michael, and so we all have nicknames. So my name throughout my life has always just been Meyer. So when I went to Peace Corps and I landed in the countryside, and they said, "What's your name?" I said, "Meyer," and they said, "Meyer," and that means a son sold in the marketplace, someone who's, you know, a parents have abandoned their kid. So they said, "Oh, you can't have that name. That's a terrible name. We can't call you sold son." So instead, my first teacher said, "I have a better name for you," and he named me Heroic Eastern Plum Blossom. And I said, I prefer Sold Son. I don't know if Plum Blossom's an improvement, but now everybody in the neighborhood just calls me Plum Blossom.
That's great. Tell us the story of the widow. It's a wonderful story.
Well, yeah, I moved into this shared courtyard home, and it's a big old mansion. It's one story. It's been divided into, you know, separate courtyards, and there's about 14 of us living in these little yards. And my neighbor is the widow. She's a woman who's, when I moved in, was 80 years old. She raised two kids and a grandchild in 65 square feet in a single room. And she's lived in the neighborhood since when Japan occupied it, actually, in the early 40s. And when I crossed the door the first day, she looked at me, and I thought, oh, she's going to hate me. I'm a foreigner. This is going to be awkward. And she said, "Listen, I have one rule for you. Public is public. Private is private." And I said, "Okay." And then every morning for the next 2 years, she would wake me at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. by walking into my door, you know, without knocking, and hand me breakfast. She would cook dumplings for me. And so she would rouse me up, and I'd stand before her in my boxer shorts as she smoked her cigarette and fed me every morning and then said, "Get to class." And so we don't have the private is private part of the rule being enforced in our house.
I guess you don't.
Everything is very public, to the point where I don't even lock my door.
Right. She keeps thinking that you ought to get up earlier, right? When do you get up at 7 o'clock?
Yeah, exactly. She'll get up at 4:30 and 5. Beijing, China doesn't have time zones, and so the sun rises in summer here at 4:30, and she'll be up, and I'll, you know, she'll scold me for being lazy, for not getting up with the sun.
Oh. Let's go to Sue from Appleton. Hi, Sue.
Hey, good morning. Great show. I just had three quick questions. One, what kind of visa do you have living there, citizenship-wise? Two, how do you teach and support yourself? Mm-hmm. And three, are you married there or are you single?
Do we go to college together? All right. You owe me $20. No, it's the visa. I'm lucky. I'm on an entrepreneurial visa, which means I'm not a tourist and I'm not a full-time employee, but I'm someone who is a scholar, is a researcher. Okay, so that's easy, and the school helps me with that in lieu of a salary, because I taught at the international school here, and what I make in a day there is what the teachers at my school make in a month. So there's no way I was going to take money from them. Secondly, how did I support myself? There's a wonderful organization called the Blakemore Foundation. It's a Seattle-based organization, and they give grants to people who want to learn Asian languages. It was founded by the AIG insurance company founder back in the 1920s, I believe. And they gave me a scholarship 3 years ago to attend a university to learn how to read Chinese. It wasn't a very large scholarship. It was about $25,000. But because I'd been living in China, in Peace Corps I made $100 a month and I couldn't spend it all. I knew how to save that money and make that money stretch. And I still have some of it, to believe it or not. Because my rent where I live it's a little less than $100 a month. And my monthly food bill is about $100, $150 a month. So I live quite cheaply, so that's easy. The third question, I don't know where to start with that. That's a really long story, so I'll pass on that one.
Oh, Michael.
Well, I mean, gosh, it's so hard. I mean, my wife is Chinese, uh-huh. But it's a weird story in that I'm American and I do my research in China. My wife is Chinese, but she just finished law school at Berkeley and just took the New York bar exam. She's more interested in working in the United States than I'm more interested in working in China.
Oh, what are you going to do about that? That's a hard one.
We're going to pick a third country, we're thinking. Maybe the next place we'll go will be like London or something.
Really?
Or England, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Sue, thanks so much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. And we have an email from Mark from Romance, Wisconsin. Michael, I work at a hospital. Yesterday, we received an announcement from the administration urging conservation of rubber medical surgical gloves. It appears that the factory in China where many gloves come from is shut down during the Olympics, and the supply of gloves is cut off until the end of the games.
Oh, that's a wonderful anecdote. I will alert the New York Times Bureau when we're done with this. I love it. A lot of factories have been shut down here to improve air pollution quality. And it's funny, Saturday and Sunday, the air was so perfect here. It
was
blue sky. The pollution index was as low as it's been in months. The weather was quite mild. There was a breeze. And then, all of a sudden today that all shifted and it's quite hazy again. And 2 years ago they were so certain that the Olympics opening ceremony would be rain-free. They even predicted 2 years before, if there is rain, it will only be a drizzle. But now they're actually predicting thunder showers tomorrow.
Oh.
So all these efforts to clean the air may have been for naught anyway.
Yeah.
So that's interesting about the shutting of factories
right.
for rubber gloves.
Yeah. How is the air? I mean, how has the air been? Do you notice an improvement, a vast improvement?
Well, it's funny. Like, when I first moved to Beijing in 1997, the air was pretty bad. You felt it. And then in 2001, when the city won the Olympics bid, they started moving industry out of the city. I mean, Beijing at one point was the country's leading manufacturing base under communism. It had the biggest petrochemical factories, the biggest heavy machinery factories and whatnot. There were 14,000 smokestacks in the city itself. And those, by and large, have been moved out now over the last decade. But what's changed is personal car ownership has skyrocketed. And so you're taking out these big, heavy polluting industries. You're putting on small, little personal polluting industries onto the road. And so I saw, it's like a double helix. You know, I saw, or parabola, I should say, you saw this bad air, also good air in the early 2000s, and now we're back to bad air again.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about the displacement of people, the people who lived in your neighborhood who are living elsewhere at this point, and how they know they have to move, the hand that you write about that will distinguish a building for removal, and who makes those decisions. Where's everybody going?
They're going away, and beyond away from here, a few people can tell you exactly where they are going to, and because land is still owned by the state here. So the state has inviolable eminent domain privileges to say, we're going to tear down this neighborhood and there's nothing you can do about it. All you can do is negotiate for a better settlement. And in the book, I follow a couple of characters, an elderly gentleman and also my co-teacher, a young woman, who go through the entire appeals process and actually get double or triple the original settlement they were offered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the old gentleman has actually rented a courtyard inside the city center, not far from where he was evicted from. And his rationale, he wanted to get a higher settlement because his grandson went to a really good elementary school at the city center, and he wanted to have a house close enough that the kid could still keep going to that school. My co-teacher, she got a higher settlement, and she moved her two parents and grandparents way out into the suburbs because she wanted to have a baby, and she figured she wanted, obviously, indoor heating and a suitable environment and her family around her.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two choices they made. Other people in the book that I follow, it's interesting, when I do journalism in China, I always know I'm getting it wrong because the annual growth of the economy is 10% a year GDP here in Beijing. People find a way. I don't know a single Chinese person, actually, in all my years being here, who's like, life has gotten worse over the past decade. Little by little, lives keep getting better in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though I sometimes in the book I find people who are being evicted and are losing everything, it's interesting to keep following them to page 300 of the book and beyond, you know, the second year, the third year, to see how they've landed on their feet. And actually, most of them have come out quite well. I don't know anyone who has said, I give up, I'm going back to my hometown in the countryside. Because if you're a migrant and you come to Beijing, there's really no looking back. You know,
right.
this is where you can make money and get a better education for your kid.
Right. But what about this sense of security? And we feel this if we're in neighborhoods where our neighbors look out for us, if we have neighborhood watches, if we've lived there for a long period of time. Looking out for each other, looking out for the neighbors, which you have had to a remarkable degree with the widow and others in your neighborhood. Isn't that lost, and isn't that a terrible loss?
It's a huge loss, and this is something that Jane Jacobs wrote about Greenwich Village in the early 1960s when New York was going to tear down parts of the village she lived in. She said, look, the beauty of these neighborhoods is that eyes are always on the street. And there's an ownership, and and you know your place in the neighborhood because people are always watching you and the role you play there. And you can, you know, it's not only a safety mechanism to keep the strangers know they're not welcome here necessarily, but it's also it's a nurturing mechanism. You know, people say hi to you, how are you doing? They know when you're sick and whatnot. That's what people miss when they move out of the lanes because these new communities are, you know, very, very tall buildings with elevators, wide streets, no commercial activity. Now, having said that, though, it's funny, when I talk to younger people, older people all uniformly say, the neighborhoods are great, we love the Hutong, we want to stay. Younger people, by and large, say, we want the modern life, we want the privacy, we want the modern house. And I asked Miss Ju, my co-teacher, in the book, I said, well, what was it like being a teenager? And she rolled her eyes, and she said, being a teenager in the Hutong meant an auntie was always watching you, ready to gossip about you. She said her first kiss had to come in the back of a moving taxi, because she couldn't find privacy in the lanes to steal away with her boyfriend at the time.
Oh my.
So that's a valid perspective, too, that you do get sick of people watching you all the time.
Yeah. More phone calls for Michael in just one moment. Michael Meyer is our guest this day before the Olympics begin in Beijing, and he's speaking to us from Beijing. The last days of old Beijing, life in the vanishing back streets of a city transformed. Michael went to China after he graduated from UW-Madison to be in the Peace Corps in 1995. He's been a longtime teacher and travel writer, publishing stories in the New York Times, the LA Times, Smithsonian, Chicago Tribune, and many other publications, and we're happy to have him with us. He spent several years in a Beijing hutong, or alleyway, living in a very tiny rented room that lacks indoor plumbing, and he writes about the daily life in the neighborhood, the people he encounters in the school where he teaches, and this urban renewal, which is taking place all over the country, and how it's been affecting China, particularly as they get ready for the opening of the games, which start tomorrow. We certainly welcome your phone calls. Probably many of you have been to China. Well, at least some of you have been to China in the last few years and can talk about changes that have taken place there and about preparations that have been made for the Olympics. I saw on the news briefly last night that there are some surface-to-air missiles at one of the venues. I want to ask Michael to see if he knows anything about that. I just thought that's dramatic for a celebration of peace and bringing the world together to have surface-to-air missiles at an Olympics. Is maybe they've been there at other Olympics, but I thought it was striking. So join us in conversation, won't you? 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee, or send an email at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls for Michael Meyer. His book, just published, The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. And let's go to Ian from Appleton. Hi, Ian.
Hi. I'm so glad that your guest is on. I just got your book for my friend that I traveled to Beijing with last year. So we had a fabulous time, and the weather was great because, it was like in April, and it had just finished raining a lot. And I guess I wanted you to talk a little bit about your food experience there, because I guess we found that people wanted to get out of their apartments all the time and eat in all these great restaurants that were really cheap. I mean, you couldn't spend $10, you know. And I guess that was kind of our favorite part. I never really much liked Chinese food, but the food over there was so delicious, and we just had so many great experiences dining with our friends in China.
I hear that. I think I can count on one hand how many meals I've cooked myself since living here, since 1995. I eat out all the time because you're right. The best food in China is the cheapest food. It's just the jiachangcai, what they call it, home-style cooking in restaurants that don't even have formal names. And that's the food I like to eat every day, too, especially Beijing food like dumplings, cold noodles in the summertime, hot pot in winter. And my neighborhood's fantastic because we have hundreds, if not 1,000, of these kinds of restaurants run by migrants. So you can eat Sichuan food. You can eat, because people come from all over the country to settle in this neighborhood, and so any variation of Chinese food you want, you can find. Do you want to talk about the surface-to-air missiles before we move on?
Oh, please, yes.
Okay.
It was just briefly on the news last night.
Yeah, well, there's 80 heads of state coming here. I mean, China always says don't politicize the Olympics. It's a sporting event. And yet it's invited more heads of state than any other host country ever for its opening ceremony. President Bush arrived here today. Putin is here and whatnot. Well, he's not a head of state, but he's still coming. But it's a very, very – the security around the stadium will be quite tight because of their presence and because of, you know, ongoing fears of terrorism.
Right. So there are surface-to-air missiles.
So I'm told. I don't know. The last time I went out to the stadium was a year ago when it was still under construction, the Bird's Nest. And I just walked right in and climbed up to the topmost level and could watch them build it, you know, as it was being built. And it was so beautiful. And I went back. I was coming into the city last night. And it was finished, obviously, and luxuriant and had a ribbon of red around it of lights and stuff. But you couldn't get near it. I mean, I thought, oh, I'll just walk up again and go check it out.
No, sirree.
It was very shut down.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Ian, for your call. We go to Reed from Clintonville next. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good morning. I was just wondering if your guest makes much contact with other expats. We have a friend who is a University of Wisconsin graduate and then a Harvard degree in education, who's now also teaching or doing something within education in Beijing. I could give his name, but I don't know if that would be
appropriate. Yeah, what's his name or her name?
Gary Malman.
Don't know. You know, Beijing has 200,000
right.
foreigners living here now.
Right.
Those days of everybody knowing each other are eroding. But that's interesting. I appreciate you asking.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you anyway.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. But there aren't very many foreigners living in your area, right?
No, I'm the only one, and it took the police a lot of convincing to allow me to live there. It took 3 months, actually, and the way you convince a Beijing police officer is you let him convince you in the end. And they finally came around to me November of 2005. They called frantically and said, please come to the police station. I thought, oh, no, I'm busted. And I got in, and they were very stern-faced, and they handed me a piece of paper in Chinese, and they said, translate that. And I read the top, and it said, The Legend of the Christmas Stockings. And I looked up, and I said, what's this? And they said, well, we're going to have a Christmas pageant, and we want to make cards, and we want to read the story of why foreigners put Christmas stockings over their mantles. We want to do it in English. And so I translated the story for them, and then we became fast friends. And then they called a week later and said, hey, Plum Blossom, would you also mind teaching us every English swear word so we know when a foreigner is cursing at us? And they would take me out for dumplings and beer, and I would call them every name in the book and compare them to their mother and on and on. And they loved it, laughed, and wrote everything down they could. So that's why I became ingratiated with the baby.
That's a great story. Thanks, Reed, for the call. Mike from West Ellis. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was in Beijing in 2003, and I've been, I mean, like most people that go there, I was basically around Tiananmen Square and the Forbidden City and some of the major sites, I guess, as you would say. And then I didn't really get the chance to go out into, obviously, Beijing's a very, very large city, into the neighborhood. And I kind of wondered, how do people commute in and around Beijing? Is it like an American city? Do people travel to the center of the city, or do they, for the most part, stay in the neighborhoods that they're in when their work day is on?
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it used to be you travel by bicycle or by public bus. But the thing is, even though Beijing has this old city, this 25 square miles, when the communists remade Beijing as the capital in 1949 when they took power, they rejected suggestions to build a new administrative center outside the old city, outside the former city wall. And instead, over this grid of 7,000 narrow lanes, they put every single, most anyway, important ministries, offices, and whatnot. And that exists to this day. So even though the wall has been torn down to ease traffic flow, it's still gridlocked downtown because there's just not enough capacity. There's not enough north-south or east-west avenues to choose from. You often can't make a left turn. There aren't any one-way streets. So people, even if they live in the suburbs, they still have to commute all the way into town usually for their jobs, and that's been a real stress point. One good thing about the Olympics, there's many good things that the Olympics have done for this city, and one is that Beijing is now in the middle of constructing the largest subway network in the world.
Oh, great.
London and New York's even. And even in the last year, we've had three more lines go on the grid, and it's getting much easier to move around in the city.
So how much of it is not up and running? How much is?
It's going to keep under construction until 2015. They're going to keep building new lines.
Mm. Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Dick is next from Warsaw. Hi, Dick.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Michael, enjoy your program very much. My reason for calling is my wife and I had the opportunity to travel to Beijing 7 years ago, sometime in the, and we had the opportunity to travel through the Hutong area.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given the impression by the tour guides we were with that there are certain sections of the Hutong were actually fashionable areas to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying they were remodeling, they were fixing them up. And I guess my question is that was that an accurate impression that they left with us, and is it still continuing?
It is. The area around Beijing has a chain of lakes near its center, and that area is becoming quite gentrified. Those homes are being fixed up, but they're often being fixed up by people from Hong Kong, Taiwan, overseas Chinese, even Americans, Europeans, and whatnot. And so although their homes are being repaired, the neighborhood's being fractured, and I think this is a problem. At the same time, I don't know. In the book, I go to Hanoi, I go to Luang Prabang, I talk about Paris and Rome and all these other different cities that have gone through preservation practices, and it seems like it's inevitable that one of the first stages that a city trying to preserve itself goes through is gentrification of a certain district. And maybe that can serve as a model for other districts. Here it's tough because the state owns the land, and so you're not free to kind of build and redo things as you wish all the time. But that area around the lakes, definitely. I mean, now you're looking at $1 million for a fixer-upper for a courtyard home. But acquiring the rights to that is very difficult because, you have 14 or 15 families that have been assigned to live in this place by the government, and then you're going to have to negotiate settlements with each of them to move them out and buy them new apartments.
Hmm.
And then the paperwork involved in preserving or doing construction for a single-story courtyard home is the same paperwork as building a brand-new 20-story office tower. And so a lot of people find, I have a friend in my neighborhood is restoring a 19th century hotel, and he's into it now. He's into $350,000 of renovations after he had budgeted $200,000, and he just laments it. He says, if I had known it was going to be this difficult, I would have torn it down also and just built one to look old, in its stead.
Okay, so some of the Hutongs still exist and will probably continue to exist, but certainly a lot fewer than there were.
I think Beijing will end up having a small medieval core like London does, like Paris. Well, Paris is a little bit bigger one, but I think that's what you're going to see, that inevitably a lot of these parcels of neighborhoods were transferred to developers in the 1990s. The only reason they haven't been knocked down yet is they just can't raise the capital to give, say, resettlement to 57,000 people.
Well, you know, we can certainly confirm the size of those hutongs because they split us up into small groups and we had lunch with some of the families, and it was hard to get four people in there.
Yeah, exactly. My neighborhood calls me Big Landlord when they joke because I have two rooms. Most people have one room that they rent, but I actually have a bedroom and a living room in our courtyard. I have the most space around. It's very, very cramped. And that's another reason people are often willing to move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dick.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. For the call. A couple lines are open, a couple minutes left. If you'd like to take one, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Wendy from Burlington, hi.
Hello. My experience was similar to the last caller. In 2004, I went to China with a group of teachers, and although my teaching assignment was in the city of Taiyuan, more in central China, we did spend a few days in Beijing, and we did visit the Hotongs. And our tour guide had grown up in a Hotong, and he talked about what your guest was saying, the closeness of the families. In fact, often the oldest son would move next door. And so the four houses facing this tiny little courtyard with a little tree and a birdhouse in it, those four families watched each other. He said he'd go off and ride his bike, and his parents never worried about him, even if they were off at work, because the families would take care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, I felt very fortunate that this particular Hotong was preserved for historical purposes, and we were able to tour. Do you know of a movement that's going on that's going to guarantee that some of these will be preserved? Because we began to see these cranes knocking them down, and it was very sad to see.
It's difficult because preservation movements always start with citizen opposition. No preservation movement in history, I think, is the government said, you know what, we should stop developing the city and getting higher tax revenues. Let's preserve it all. You know, that always starts with public opposition. And even though China allows class action lawsuits and 11,000 people have filed a lawsuit to try to save their neighborhood, that's all being dismissed on procedural grounds. Those cases never get heard. The way you advance as a bureaucrat in China right now is to prove what you built, not what you preserved. Development is the only principle. That's an actual slogan you hear all the time here. So there is sort of scattered, there's a lot of photographing that takes place. That sort of documentation rather than, say, marches or petition drives or sponsorships and these other things you see in the States when people start preserving things. That area around the lakes, this lake area is named Hohai, some of those neighborhoods now the neighborhood is being allowed to stay, and they're trying to install electricity and plumbing. They're trying a pilot program. But again, it costs the government a great deal of money, so I'm not too optimistic that that's going to happen for the rest of the city. The government did mark 25 areas of the city as protected, and then right away it tore down the first one and said, in order to protect this neighborhood, we're going to tear it down and build it anew, and they kicked everybody out and built these million-dollar courtyard homes. So it has a nice appearance, but again, the neighborhood has been obliterated.
Yeah. Thanks, Wendy, for the call. How are you going to celebrate the Olympics?
I don't have a single ticket, and I have no desire to go to any event. I'm going to do what my neighbors are doing. They can't afford tickets either. So we'll sit, we'll put a TV out on the lane, and we'll sit outside and watch the event together.
And have food.
Have lots of food.
Yeah,
it'll be great.
Yeah. Nicholas from Milwaukee, running short on time. Hi.
Hi. I'll be brief. I guess I have a brother who was in Taiwan for about 10 years, and he's often sort of frustrated by what he sees as kind of political complacency, and rather just more interest in making it a buck. And so I guess I'm curious about whether or not Michael has gotten opinions about the Taiwan's relationship with the mainland and just how he feels about that.
The Taiwan issue is we don't have enough time for that one. I did get to go to Taipei to look at preservation practices there, which was quite interesting. But it's not a situation that, even in my neighborhood, people often ask me, like, well, why is America in Iraq? And isn't that what powerful countries do? And, you know, they are interested in the war. People never come up to me and say, let's talk about Tibet. Let's talk about Taiwan, these issues that people in the States ask me about. People here are much more interested in America's position in the world. I think it's actually interesting because Americans always ask me about China's position in the world and situations, you know, like Tibet and Taiwan. But people here just don't talk about it. And maybe that's because they just assume, you know, they assume they know the answer to it, so they don't want to discuss it.
Mm-hmm. And it may be difficult to figure out what America's position in the world is right now.
Oh, exactly. And I think it's difficult to figure out what China's position in the world. It's also difficult to talk about Beijing because cities are always changing. When you describe a city, you're dipping your toe in a flowing river and just testing the temperature at that time. And so my book describes 2003 to 2008, and already I feel like, boy, I'm going to have to do some, you know, I need to do another edition coming up next year. Beijing's a city where they put new traffic maps out every 3 months because
the other one's
getting outdated, you know.
So I'm still following.
I know everybody in the book. I mean, I went around and gave them finished copies of the book today. They're still alive. They're still in my life, and their stories are still changing, as is mine and as is the city.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael, so much. Or Plum Blossom, we should call you. Thanks for the book. It was great. And have fun during the Olympics. The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanquishing Back Streets of a City Transformed. Michael Mayer is our guest. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. Until Monday, Veronica Rickert with you tomorrow. Thanks.